You may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, Mr. Downey. This is a serious case involving a lawyer who misappropriated a client's money in order to fund a financially struggling law practice. And not just any client. Respondent stole money from a not-for-profit, the Save a Life for Geno Foundation, whose purpose was to provide scholarships to underprivileged children for their education. Respondent represented the foundation since 2010. In 2015, Respondent was asked to take the necessary steps to have the foundation's money moved from Bank of America into a new account at Commerce Bank to be controlled by Donna Campbell, then the primary administrator of the foundation. Upon receipt of the client's money in September 2015, totaling $16,943, Respondent placed the money, deposited the money into her trust account. Over the following many months, Ms. Campbell's efforts to get Respondent to turn over the foundation's money were fruitless. She eventually hired another attorney to write a demand letter to Respondent in June 2016. The next month, in July 2017, Ms. Campbell filed a complaint against the Respondent with the Office of Chief Disciplinary Counsel. In due course, Kelly Dillon, the informant's certified fraud examiner, audited both the Respondent's trust account and operating account. Those audits disclosed the following. The foundation's funds, $16,943, were deposited into the trust account on September 18, 2015. Immediately prior to the deposit, the trust account had a balance of $213 in it. Within 10 days after that deposit, Respondent began misappropriating money from the foundation. The first withdrawal from the trust account was a check for $2,000 payable to the Respondent's law firm. Between September 28, 2015, and July 12, 2016, there were a total of 17 withdrawals of foundation funds from the trust account. Eight of these withdrawals, totaling $10,250, were by check and were deposited directly into the respondent's operating account. Six were cash withdrawals, totaling $5,200. Only three of the withdrawals, totaling $1,565, were either paid to or for the benefit of the foundation. Respondent personally signed all the checks withdrawing money, personally signed the withdrawal slips, taking out cash from the trust account, and she was the bookkeeper for her law firm. She was solely responsible for the misappropriations. Also of significance, Respondent misappropriated the foundation's funds even after attending a trust accounting CLE that informant required her to attend after she was admonished in 2016 due to a prior overdraft of her trust account. Respondent's failure to timely deposit the entirety of the foundation's funds into the Commerce Bank account and her theft of those funds impeded the charity's ability to hold its annual golf tournament, which was the principal funding source for the charity's scholarships. Respondent failed to pay back the money to the foundation for over 21 months until June 26, 2017. The repayment was made 11 months after Ms. Campbell filed her complaint with the informant on behalf of the foundation, 4 months after the informant filed its information, and just over 1 month before the DHP hearing in this case. Ultimately, the money used to make the repayment to the foundation was drawn on the Charles Schwab account of respondent's parents. In other words, having misappropriated the foundation's money, respondent had to use her parents' funds in order to pay back the foundation. The panel found properly that respondent violated three rules. First, 4-1.15 on safekeeping property by failing to preserve the foundation's money in the trust account. 4-8.4C by engaging in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, and deceit in the theft of the foundation's money. And rule 4-1.4 by failing to respond to inquiries from the client regarding the status of its funds. The panel recommended disbarment. Informant concurs in the violations found by the panel and its disbarment recommendation.
So opposing counsel says there was just one case of misconduct. It was the inadvertent mishandling of the client's funds when the money got put into the wrong account originally. And I take it from your stating that there were 13 checks to either herself or to cash and not to the fund, that you think there were multiple instances of misconduct.
Correct, Judge Stith. There are three defenses slash mitigators raised by the respondent in her brief. One is that she claims this was a single incident of inadvertent mishandling of client money, as though the thefts were just a big mistake. In fact, in our view, there were 14 separate instances of misappropriation from the trust account, covering a 10-month period, and it defies belief, in our view, to conclude that she did not know at some point that she was taking money that did not belong to her. As I said, the account only had $213 in it before she deposited these funds.
Now, I know you're seeking disbarment, and respondents think that's a little bit too harsh in light of Coleman and some other cases. Can you distinguish Coleman, in which the court issued a state suspension, from the facts here?
Sure, Judge Russell. In our view, first of all, in Coleman, I think the court found that there was a level of lack of knowledge regarding the rules that they gave some credence to, and on that basis said that he should be given a state suspension with probation. In our view, it's not applicable here because 5.225, the probation rule, explicitly says that probation is not appropriate in a case where the offense is a disbarable offense. In our view, clearly this court has found in the Ehler, McMillan, and Ferris cases, that line of cases, that the conversion of client money knowingly and intentionally is, as a baseline sanction, a disbarable offense. So we don't believe that 5.225 applies.
Coleman involved commingling of funds. Did it involve misuse of funds?
My recollection, Judge Breckenridge, is that Mr. Coleman wrote a check to the bar, perhaps for some fee out of the trust account that was not his money. So in that sense, I believe he was using client money from the trust account to pay that $750 fee. It may have been the disciplinary fee, actually, after he was previously sanctioned that he used trust account funds. The second issue that respondent raises is she repeatedly points out in mitigation that she repaid the funds to the foundation. As indicated, the foundation was forced to hire a separate counsel to try to recover that money in June of 2016. She did not respond to that attorney's request for that money be turned over. It was a year later before she actually turned it over, and it was under the cloud of this disciplinary proceeding. It took her 21 months to repay the money, and that repayment was made just weeks before the DHP hearing in this case. Under those circumstances, informant doesn't believe that the repayment of the money should be treated as a mitigator. Then the third issue that is raised in respondent's brief, without any support or explanation, is that she blames the misconduct on health-related issues. She mentions PTSD and clinical depression. She does conveniently avoid claiming that these conditions are mitigators under 5.285 because she didn't raise that as an affirmative defense. Instead, she claims that it goes to her state of mind. What was her state of mind in taking these funds? Informant's belief is that respondent's state of mind is more properly reflected in the fact that she took this money over a 10-month period on 14 separate occasions and then failed to produce the requisite client ledger and other records when the OCDC came calling. The thefts were both knowing and intentional, and we don't believe that the court should give any credence to the medical issues that are raised by the respondent. As I said, this court's cases, as well as the ABA sanctions, 4.11, clearly set a baseline sanction of disbarment for this type of conduct. There's no doubt that there was injury to the client. Foundation had to hire an attorney to try to collect this money, and ultimately it impaired their ability to fundraise through this golf tournament.
But was the client made whole?
So the client is made whole. Actually, she ends up paying a $17,000 check to the client, which was more than actually had been taken, because she had used $1,565 for the client's benefit during the course of that 10-month period. So in June of 26th of 2017, she actually pays back $17,000. The client is made whole. Again, so the client is given restitution. In our view, that's still
was
not.
Was the client out extra attorney's fees? Because
I don't believe that was
no
part of the record.
Was brought up.
I don't believe it was part of the record. What she paid Mr. Ahern from DuBail Judge to write this letter. I'm not sure that she was out
but it was
any fees.
It was a month before the hearing.
It was weeks before the hearing, about a month before the disciplinary hearing panel hearing when she made that payment. Mm-hmm. There are mitigators and aggravators. She has a prior disciplinary history in aggravation. She was given this 2016 admonition for violating 1.14-1.15 and for failing to cooperate with the informant's investigation. She was also suspended under 5.245 for taxes in 2009. There was a selfish and dishonest motive present in the case. There's a pattern of misconduct over many months. The victim is vulnerable. The foundation is a charitable organization. There are multiple violations of the rules. There's substantial experience in the practice of law. She graduated from law school and got her license in 1994. There was, in our view, not only while there was restitution, there was indifference to restitution, an aggravator under 9.22 subparagraph J of the ABA sanctions. That restitution, as indicated, did not occur until the very last minute under the cloud of this disciplinary proceeding. There are also mitigators. She was cooperative in the proceedings before the disciplinary hearing panel, and there was evidence, both in the form of letter and live testimony, regarding her character and reputation. However, none of those character witnesses or letter writers had any personal knowledge of the particulars of this case. Respondent argues that the character and reputation mitigator alone should warrant the reduced sanction of a state suspension with probation. As indicated, we believe that the mitigators are far outweighed by the aggravators in this case and should not reduce the baseline sanction of disbarment. In addition, 5.225 does not provide for probation in a case such as this, where it's a disbarable offense. Respondent engaged in professional misconduct involving a failure to safekeep property, misappropriation, deceit, and a failure to communicate with her client in the handling of money that was entrusted to her by this charitable entity. Each violation occurred on multiple occasions over a significant period of time. The totality of the misconduct, combined with a prior disciplinary history and consideration of applicable mitigators and aggravators, in our view, warrants the respondent's disbarment. Thank you.
May it please the court, Michael Downey for the respondent, Corey Darvish. As Mr. Pratzel has indicated, and as we have all admitted, this is a very serious case. I'm reminded I did a CLE a few years ago with Mr. Pratzel. Mr. Pratzel said to the audience when I was co-presenting with him that lawyers generally don't get in trouble for substantive mistakes. They generally get in trouble for law practice mistakes. And this is one of those cases. Ms. Darvish, as the record makes clear, did a very good substantive job for her clients. She was well respected. She served as a leader of the Municipal Lawyers Association. She was very active in a number of community service areas, including organizing the court-appointed special advocates, and did a lot of great things. Unfortunately, as the record also indicates, and is all too common for lawyers to get in trouble, she lost that key assistant that was able to keep everything running. And in 2015, she took over her own trust account. Now, there are discussions that she has a prior admonition, but I emphasize to you that the admonition related to an overdraft that Ms. Darvish herself reported on September 16th of 2015. The checks that were received in this issue were received 2 days later on September 18th, 2015. So we're talking about it as being a prior history, but really what it is a lawyer who, losing that assistant, hits a rough patch, and it's a single rough patch. Now, it is true, and unfortunately I don't have a great answer. She received the funds and she withdrew the funds. She withdrew them over a period of time. Ms. Darvish doesn't have a great answer.
But that doesn't sound like a single misstep to me. That sounds like multiple instances of theft.
It's a single mishandling of a client check.
Putting it in the wrong account, taking it out and paying it to herself is an additional violation, is it not? And why is it not theft?
Yes. Ms. Darvish's testimony was that she had inadvertently placed the money in the trust account, and that the reason actually she transferred the money over to her operating account was at the advice of her banker. And she says, I never should have listened to the banker. The banker obviously didn't understand trust accounting. She's accepted responsibility, but you are correct. It was on multiple occasions.
And after she took the trust account CLE, is that correct?
I believe that's correct, yes.
Okay.
So, Ms. Darvish, as indicated, when she learned about the overdraft, and just to kind of clarify things a little bit also, this was a small nonprofit, so she wasn't contacted about the money for some time. The checks were received in September. I believe the next contact she had was in May. And interestingly enough, Ms. Darvish at that time actually gave the client a checkbook, suggesting that she didn't realize that the money was gone. On top of that, she actually had gone through an audit with Ms. Dillon, as indicated the paralegal for the disciplinary counsel's office, had met with Ms. Dillon in December of 2015, at the time when, as we talked about, she was unfortunately mishandling this money. So if the question is, was she intentionally doing it, it simply doesn't make sense. Why would she do it when she knew Ms. Dillon was looking at her accounts? Why would she actually give a checkbook to the client to draw upon funds that were not there? The answer seems to be that she truly didn't realize what was going on. It's very clear that there are some problems. She has admitted she did not properly reconcile her accounts. At least at that point, she did learn how to do that and did it subsequently. But like many lawyers who find themselves in disciplinary trouble, they often start doing the right thing going forward and don't necessarily look backward. In fact, when the checks were missing, Ms. Darvish immediately told the client, "We'll look for them, we'll find them, I'll be responsible." In fact, you actually have what she had dictated for her assistant to call and tell the client, Ms. Campbell, on page 401 of the record. That call was made, she immediately took responsibility, but she testified she didn't look at her trust account because she thought, how could the money be there when Ms. Dillon had just investigated that account?
How does that fit with Mr. Pratzel saying that she did send three checks to the client, so she must have found the money for that purpose?
She testified that she initially made the deposit into the account, the $500 check. Subsequently, when there was an overdraft, and I believe that was in early June of 2016, she attempted to make it whole, and she said, "I wrote the check intending to write it out of my operating account. I accidentally wrote it on my trust account, and almost by happenstance, it actually happened that there was funds in there for the foundation." But her testimony was she actually intended to use her own money to pay that account. So.
Testimony, she didn't know the foundation's funds were in the trust account, whose funds she thought they were that she was writing all those checks to herself?
She actually intended to write the check from her operating account, which would have been...
The 14 checks?
Well, the $1,000 check.
No, what about the
14 checks?
Frankly,
she wrote them out of her trust account to herself or to cash, and if she was mistaken that the trust funds were in there, did she account for whose funds she thought she was writing all those checks on?
The record doesn't indicate a good answer to that question. So, the other thing to realize about this was that Ms. Dillon did do her investigation. There were no problems found with the account with any of the other funds, and that's why we talk about this was problems with a single client's deposit. Mr. Pratzel has admitted, and I think it's worth going over, there is substantial evidence of mitigation here. She accepted responsibility from the very beginning. She immediately told the client that this is my problem. I know I had those checks. I need to find your money. And she went looking for it. She ultimately did find the checks and forwarded them to the disciplinary counsel's office and said, "I found them in my trust account." It took some time to do that. She was very forthcoming about that. There is testimony actually in the record on the appendix, pages 92 and 93, where Ms. Dillon indicates that Ms. Darvish was very cooperative, that she seemed genuinely interested in learning how to better handle her trust account. This was in December of 2015, and in fact, there's testimony that she made changes to her trust account. She did make, as Mr. Pratzel has already indicated, full repayment to the clients plus additional funds. The client actually received more. Mr. Pratzel has also made a point of mentioning it was her parents' money. Frankly, that was the only source of money. There's a reference to the fact that her practice was struggling. Like many Missouri sole practitioners, Ms. Darvish's practice was always struggling. And so it wouldn't be seen that that would be a motivator for what happened here. In fact, that was sort of the normal course for many of the years since she had opened her practice. And in fact, that was why she had to go to her parents and ask them to provide the money to repay the funds.
But she didn't do so until after, you know, she was under investigation by OCDC, and it was a month prior to, or a few weeks prior to the hearing. So other than those charges being brought against her, maybe she would have never repaid. We don't know that, but
correct.
I'm just saying it took that kind of pressure to get her to make the client whole.
Ms. Darvish had certainly indicated that she had always intended to repay and that she was taking responsibility. Every indication was she was going to make sure that the foundation ultimately did receive its funds, although as indicated, it did take a substantial period to get those funds to the client. One of the things also that's actually reflected in Ms. Darvish's letter was she was concerned once the bar complaint had been filed that she was not supposed to be communicating with the client, and that certainly caused further delay. I will add that from my own experience, that's a common problem lawyers have, that they believe that once a client has filed a bar complaint, they shouldn't contact them. Obviously, those of us that do this a lot know better, and certainly say, no, you should make whole things whole as quickly as possible. But that is a common mistake lawyers make. So there was cooperation throughout this proceeding. The answer indicates acceptance of responsibility. If you look at the answer, you'll actually see we do not contest the 1.15 violations related to trust account operations. We also do not contest the 1.4 failure to properly communicate with the client. It is admitted that the foundation did reach out to Ms. Darvish, and Ms. Darvish was not prompt in responding to those communications. So we've actually admitted a fair amount of the conduct here. There was a question that Mr. Pratzel received, and I think it's worth a little bit of mention, regarding other cases. And the Missouri Supreme Court has made very clear we are a progressive discipline state. And the cases that were referenced, I believe, were the Eller case, the Ferris case, and the McMillan case. In each of those instances, a lawyer was disbarred for trust account violations. But in each of those instances, the lawyer had lots of other prior problems and prior workings with the disciplinary system. Ms. Eller was actually undergoing mentoring, and she had to file quarterly reports when her problems arose. She actually also defaulted in discovery for one client while mishandling funds of another client. So there were multiple clients involved, and there was this history, a much greater history, of progressive discipline. The Ferris case, the lawyer never admitted his misconduct. In fact, I believe he came before this court and asked that no penalty be imposed. He misrepresented what had happened to the funds throughout the proceeding, indicating that he had not written checks when, in fact, he had written checks. Here, Ms. Darvish has never challenged any of the validity of the bank records or what they showed. Also, Mr. Ferris also had a prior admonition that related to a wholly unrelated matter, I believe it was about 4 or 5 years before the discipline case at issue. The McMillan case, similarly, was an overdraft case, although in that particular case, the person had a gambling addiction, had already had some monitoring from the disciplinary counsel's office, and actually made, according to the opinion, hundreds of cash withdrawals, primarily to fund his gambling habits. Obviously, that's very different than what happened here. Ms. Darvish did make multiple withdrawals, but they were only from the one client's funds, and they were over a much more limited period of time and limited amount of activity than Mr. McMillan did. Also, I believe Mr. McMillan also had a prior monitoring agreement in place. And on top of that, there was concern because he had ignored certain client cases and actually had sacrificed the client's legal positions, which obviously is not an issue here. The purpose of lawyer discipline, as we all know, is to protect the public and to protect the integrity of the bar. In this particular case, there was a client who was harmed by serious conduct. The client has been made more than whole. The public has been protected. Ms. Darvish has a practice since 1994 with no disciplinary incidents until 2016. I realize there's a tax issue there, but she was actually only a tax suspension for about a month in 2009. The other question is the integrity of the legal profession. We believe that the imposition of formal discipline here, such as a state suspension, would be adequate formal discipline to protect the integrity of the bar, and believe that no further penalty would need to be imposed. Therefore, we ask for a state suspension. And if the bench has no further questions, I'll yield back the rest of my time. Thank you.
Excuse me if I jump around a little bit. With regard to graduated progressive discipline, I would only say that sometimes a single act of misconduct warrants the ultimate sanction. And in this case, stealing money from a client, I think, warrants that ultimate sanction of disbarment. Secondly, she does have a prior history. That tax suspension, whether it was for a month or a year, is considered by this court to be a disciplinary suspension. So she has an admonition, a suspension, more serious than the Ferris and the McMillan case, which was a monitoring agreement, as I recall. So the fact is the progressive discipline does not apply in a case such as this, where someone engages in this kind of misconduct. Mr. Downey mentioned why would she mishandle client money when the OCDC was sniffing around with her accounts, looking at her accounts? The fact is that if you take a look at Exhibit G, the spreadsheet prepared by Ms. Dillon, along with her testimony at pages 85 to 88 of the appendix, you will find that Ms. Dillon testifies that the operating account received funds from the trust account several times when that operating account was at net at zero are in a negative balance position. So one way to look at it might be, I did this inadvertently, I didn't know what I was doing, whose money this was. The other way to look at it is, I needed money for my personal life and for my law firm, and therefore took it from the foundation. There's some mention, confusing to some extent, that this was a single mishandling of checks, that maybe it should not have gone into the trust account. In our view, that was the one thing she did ethically, was put the money into the trust account. What she didn't do was, as soon as those checks cleared, put it right into the Commerce Bank account, or even better, take the checks from Boatman, from Bank of America, and put them right into the Commerce account. For whatever reason, they go into a trust account where she starts taking the money within 10 days. The bottom line on this case, I think, is that this is an attorney who has engaged in serious misconduct that was meant to prop up a struggling law practice as well as a personal life of expenses, and that the aggravators in the case far outweigh the two mitigators that were mentioned. I would ask the court to enter an order disbarring this respondent from the practice of law. Thank you.
Case will be submitted.